you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to Treasury Cats, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is our very extra special 50th episode of Treasury Cast. So to celebrate that milestone, I thought we would do something a little bit different. Instead of talking about a specific Treasury comic book, this episode will be featuring an interview with the legendary Alex Ross. I don't need to go into the details of who Alex Ross is. You all know who Alex Ross is. So I thought, let's get right to it. So please enjoy this talk I had with the great Alex Ross. All right, so Alex, like, let's go back to your origin story with this format. Like, what are your memories of buying these treasuries for the first time? Do you remember them?
Well, yeah, absolutely. To me, they're one of the brightest spots of collecting in the 1970s, my childhood period. And just to give everybody a good sense of where I come at it, I'm a kid born in 1970. Now I'm 50 years old. That's where I'm like a six-year-old kid when the thing that probably reached the most number of people from that format was the promotion and announcement based around the Battle of the Century between Superman and Spider-Man. And I'm pretty certain I remember that as being one of those things that was a mail order thing available for everybody. Any catalog you might have had access to coming into your average American home would have given you exposure to that. And that would have likely been the thing that opened up the entire format for me, whereas from then on I would have seen them at grocery stores, you know, on the magazine racks, and little bit by little bit been able to beg for the ones that I got in those years before I ever earned any kind of allowance.
Yeah, like I've mentioned on the show before, like they weren't at every store that I shopped at, so they only appeared in stores that had, you know, a bigger space for these books. So when I saw them, I just begged my parents to buy me every one I could get my hands on because they seemed kind of rare. Were they plentiful when you were growing up? Once they started, DC Marvel really were cooking, did you see them all the time?
I would assume that certain grocery stores definitely had them there along with everything else. But then again, not every grocery store had a strong selection of comics. But of course, back then in the 70s, that would have been your primary place to find them.
Right.
You know, I didn't discover the direct market shop in the city I lived in, which was Lubbock, Texas. I didn't discover that until like 81. So, you know, all I had was these moments of going out on shopping trips, or if I made my way over to the 7-Eleven near my home to see a spinner rack, you know, with comics. I got the comics pretty much in the only place that would have reached the greatest number of people. But by the time I was going to a comic book store, direct market store, you know, those things were pretty much dead by the early 80s, you know. So to me, it sort of represented an outreach to a greater number of people that you hopefully would pick up the kid who can get their parent talked into buying an actual $1 product, you know, which still, you know, you're looking at from the economics of the time would have seemed like a big get.
Yeah, it's like three or four times what a normal comic cost at that time.
Yeah, and they figured that, like, okay, if I get you this thing, you're going to be satisfied for a while and leave me alone for a while, right? Or you get this one thing as opposed to maybe the two books or three or four books you were begging for. You know, I know my parents would have watched their money very closely. They didn't have a lot. So this was not something I could just get every one of these I ever saw. In fact, some of the ones I dearly loved and poured through on the stands at grocery stores, I didn't own until I was able to get them back later as a teenager and
you know,
having a bit more money. But like ones like the famous Batman Neil Adams cover with him with what looks like a dead Robin on the cover and Rachel Gould in the background, or even honestly the Muhammad Ali Superman fight. I was only able to read that on the stands and not own it until years later. So a lot of my collection, which I have all of them now, was based upon yearning of something I either saw in person or, frankly, the print ads in the comics of the time would show you just this whole feast of different covers of the different editions, and they just would look so magical, like, oh, where's that? What's that one? And, you know, the idea that they had done a famous first edition of All-Star Comics with all those obscure characters that I had yet to learn everything about was just such a tantalizing prospect.
Yeah. You know, of course, they had those ads with all the mail order forms. And, you know, my parents never gave her money for any of those. So I just had to see those ads and know that, you know, I could have maybe gotten them, but I just had to, you know, hopefully see them on the stands or something.
Yeah. I mean, having no real discernible income of my own, I couldn't take that step forward, and I didn't understand anything about ordering something. I mean, that seemed beyond me. You know, everything to me was all about begging when I was a kid. You know, so I got things by the grace of my parents, probably my mother, you know, indulging me more than my father would have been. But not, I don't expect he was on the grocery trips with us as much. But,
right.
No, I look back at those, and much like kids who grew up in the 70s like I did, where you had those toys that were available then that comparatively price-wise, you think, how could I have not been able to get every single Mego figure when I was a kid? And you think, they're so cheap, but then economically, based upon wherever you were at, wherever your family, what money you had, those things weren't like, you know, everybody couldn't get every toy they ever wanted, but now, as soon as you become an adult, you have your own disposable money, you think, well, geez, I should be able to have every one of these things.
Yeah, I don't fondly recall, but I remember a time I was in a toy store, and I saw a bunch of Migos at the cutout bin for 39 cents each. And I didn't buy them because I wanted to buy my Star Wars figure. And I look back on it now, I'm like, if I had bought that end cap full of Fantastic Four dolls, mint on card, I probably could have bought a car or something. You know, they were worth a fortune. And I passed them up because I was a dumb kid and it was 1981. So I didn't think about that stuff. So, well, you already answered one of the other things I wanted to ask you about was, have you kept your Treasury collection over the years? But you say you have. I have to ask you, where do you store them? Because that seems to be a bugaboo with a lot of collectors, is where they can just keep these things that they don't keep flopping over or get damaged in some way.
Well, I have a cabinet that I've had through multiple homes now. So for like at least the last 25 years, I've got a wood cabinet that sits in my living room. So right around just a few feet from my office here, my home office, I have, it's got glass fronts to it. I mean, this is like one of those things that would be for displaying plates and stuff like that.
Right.
But basically, the size of the shelves that were adjustable to certain heights were perfect for the height format of the treasuries to sit in. So they each are bagged and boarded, and they're all standing upright, and they're all, you know, basically in an area closest to my heart. Because even though I've got loads of comics in storage, I've got a home library, you know, which means you took a bedroom and then converted it into
right.
You know, just shelves all around. But this is one of those things that meant so much to me in my childhood that I always felt this strong connection to the tabloids. And so I've always wanted to keep these things nearby. And it's been easy since there was only a finite amount of these things published by either DC or Marvel. What's funny, in the last decade or so, is now you've got all these new editions of things that now get added to the same format that I'm trying to stick on the same shelves, where now they're pressing beyond the realm of what I've got space for. And, you know, and I collect other things that are even in a similar shape and format, like there's poster books
that
are contemporary that get made more readily now. And we did have, you know, a couple of those things made by both DC and Marvel back in the 70s, that fit right in that same size format in a way. So anyway, yeah, I keep the stuff well organized and nearby, and I'm probably one of the few people working professionally who has more instances where I go back to them for either as a reference source or an inspiration source of something where, you know, I'm thinking about a composition and I'd like to emulate a certain thing that I remember from either figure drawing style, or I want to just outright take an existing cover and do it again, but in my style, assuming my style is somehow a conversion of those things into something new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like even sitting on my desk now, I've wanted for the 80th anniversary this year to do like a painting recreating the All-Star Comics number 3 cover.
Ah.
You know, or even the Wiz Comics number 2 cover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that I think would make, you know, a worthwhile thing for this odd year of anniversaries.
Well, that, I mean, that leads perfectly to one of the things I wanted to ask you about specifically is, like, what are some of your favorite – we'll break them down by company. What are some of your favorite DC treasuries, either ones that you just loved as a kid or ones that you find you go back to or you think that were just particularly effective?
Well, you know, you got to give DC – mainly the biggest credit in this whole thing, because their investment was early, and I think that they were ahead of Marvel. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you know better, I believe DC was doing it before Marvel did.
They were, yeah.
And they put their money where their mouth was more, where they created more artwork that was specific to the treasuries, and by kind of doubling down on the event spectacle of the Superman-Spider-Man crossover, they followed it up with 2 to 3 more of their own where they thought, well, if that worked, pit Superman against Wonder Woman,
right.
Shazam, and
Muhammad Ali.
Oh, how about Mama Ali? And then, you know, of course, you got the reuniting of the two companies with Batman Hulk and Superman Spider-Man again. And, you know, those things are the epics that really make this format sing, because there the artists are working with the pages as a real canvas to really stretch their art out. I mean, when they reprinted stuff that Neil Adams did from comics, it would look spectacular in this format. But when he was given the full format to use through the Muhammad Ali book, you know, nothing compares to how much of a seismic impact those pages had on artists working in comics at that time. You know, it was really having the artist approach that spread and saying, this is going to be larger in somebody's lap as they're reading it. It's going to have a sense of breadth and power. And, you know, of course, this would inspire me 20-some years later when I would be replicating the format with new stories.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait to. We'll get to those. I'm very excited to talk about those. But, I mean, those are like – so, I mean, when you were a kid or when we even – well, like I said, not even when you were a kid, as an adult now – are there some of the – I mean, obviously the originals are amazing because, yeah, DC knew that, you know, with Superman, Spider-Man, it got to do it special. But, like, in terms of, like, their reprint books, were there any that you thought were particularly, like, hey, this really holds together as a collection of stories? I mean, obviously Treasuries are the early trade paperbacks. Are there any of those that you are particularly just – you know, are particularly beloved to you?
Well, you know, I actually, in preparation for this call, I grabbed a bunch of the ones that I would have actually owned – as a little kid, instead of when I finally took my money and bought out everything. Because back in the mid-80s, the price for any of these things, none of them had graduated in price. They were exactly,
yep.
You would have been paying a dollar for them in the mid-80s.
Yep.
So none of them were valued at a higher growth. So I was able to fill up my collection with no trouble at all. But you know, ones that they did at Marvel, surprisingly, for Hulk, under those titling of Rampaging Hulk number 24 and number 26. I don't know where they got the numbering from on there. I'm, you know, not sure where's the number 25 in that. But
I think that's a Spider-Man Hulk team-up, I think, is number 25. I think that's them at the Olympics
or
something.
That's number 27.
Oh, 27, okay.
Oh, wait, no, you're right. I'm sorry, I'm out of order on this. It's 27 is a reprint of a Spider-Man Hulk story, but then there's 25 is the Winter Olympics.
There you
one.
Go.
Okay, yeah, you got it right. Well, anyway, so, like, yeah, and I did pull that, actually. And I owned that. I owned all of these in a row. These are ones I got as a kid, but, like, so stuff that they were collecting from, like, the Hulk saga, where you're going to Counter-Earth with Adam Warlock and with all those, what were the half-men, half-animal?
Yeah, the high evolutionary characters. I forget the name of those things. They weren't the Un-Men, that Swamp Thing. I forget what the name,
right.
the name of his creatures were.
But, like, you know, that storyline with ultimately Adam Warlock's death and then resurrection, it reads very powerfully in the context of a whole collected format. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or when the other collection that came a couple after that, the one with Betty and her transformation into Harpy, you know, like those things are really, they amped up the sense of, however powerful that may have read as a comic series, compiled into one big graphic format, it has this real punch to it. So those were probably the stories that had some resonance for me, more so than DC would have been hobbled in effect by doing more collections of stories that were from their deep past, so stuff from either the 40s or from the 1960s, where they weren't exactly competing with the impetuous nature of Marvel storytelling that had this long-range epic goal of, you know, multiple issues connecting a storyline that kept telling a new soap opera.
Right.
Whereas you could grab a bunch of offbeat Batman stories that would have, in some cases, great Neil Adams art, throw them all together and not have a sense of a continuity thread flowing between these things, meaning that there was a greater adventure that had occurred. And so that's where Marvel would sing, is that they could do that with their material and have it have a greater impact.
Actually, again, that leads perfectly into something else I wanted to ask you about. I mean, you've already mentioned Neil Adams. But I've noticed over the years of analyzing all these books is, of course, a lot of these all these artists, when their work was reprinted in a Treasury format, and they didn't think it would be ever reprinted at that size. And I think some artists benefit from the larger size, even some of the Golden Age artists. I think like H.G. Peter, his stuff to me is a lot easier just to read. At the larger size, because his stuff is so dense. And then you blow it up a little, and you're like, oh, this is – I didn't like H.G. Peter when I was a kid. And then when I started getting the Treasury editions, like, oh, I actually kind of like this work because I can discern what I'm looking at. What do you think as a professional artist? Like, are there artists that you really enjoyed seeing at a larger size, like just being able to really drink in all the detail they put in that might have been lost when it was, you know, printed at the normal comic book size?
Boy, you know, I mean, if you're talking about the much older stuff, I can't think of a great example of that, other than I did like seeing the archaic kind of qualities of early comic stuff, like particularly when it came to the Fawcett stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, C.C. Beck's work, either from Wiz Comics number 1 or from the later stories that were compiled into those multiple treasuries. Strangest Cases, you know, like that had two great Neil Adams stories and, of course, Bernie Wrightson's depiction of Batman from Swamp Thing.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that would just blow your socks off in terms of the impact of it. So, obviously, the format elevated Neil Adams' work to a new height of, you know, just putting together his Ra's al Ghul story was, you know, epic in nature, you know, to be given that format and very appropriate. Like, they quickly recognized what they needed to focus in on with something like that. But, of course, they still shied away from some of their more slightly lesser known characters, which is weird to say that about a character like Green Lantern or Green Arrow, but like they could have taken stuff like that, put it in this format. And so we don't have a lot of the sort of B-list characters getting a shot in this format. You know, if it didn't stray too far from Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, so you never got like really a full Flash one or Green Lantern.
Right, yeah, that's right.
You know, and with Marvel, you did have some oddities there. The fact that there's actually the Howard the Duck one with the Defenders in it.
Right.
Such an oddity, or, you know, I mean, you did get one Avengers Treasury edition, which back then seemed like the Avengers were almost a B-level team for them by comparison with the much more popular Fantastic Four, which is weird to think. And, of course, you know, X-Men was far from being recognized a major force at that time, even though, you know, these things really, if their heyday would have been between, like, what, 75 and 1980?
Basically, yeah.
So it's interesting what didn't get that spotlight. And there's so much material that, you know, when we look back in the history of it, we think, like, how did this stuff not rate better presentation? But it was all about reaching the greatest number of people and what properties they might have a recognition of.
Yeah, I've remarked that Marvel was a little more democratic when it came to who got these books, because, like, they did one on the Defenders. They did one on Master of Kung Fu. You just mentioned Howard the Duck, but yet DC never did Flash or Green Lantern. You know, I mean, you're like, wow, really? Like, the Flash doesn't earn his own treasury, but Shang-Chi got one? That seems kind of amazing. But, of course, DC had to make room for the 75 Rudolph treasuries that they published over the course of a five-year period.
I think they figured at that point everybody in America knew who Rudolph was, and that's something that a parent might have bought for their kid, regardless of sex or, you know, regardless of age, that they would have felt very comfortable with that. So in a way, you can kind of go, oh, yeah, I guess I can see that, you know. But, yeah, it feels like a missed opportunity. And it's weird that the growing direct market for comic stores didn't have more of a place that could have been a fostering of that. Like, say, we're getting all these comics that now get made specifically because there's direct market. So why shouldn't there have been a greater investment in this format that, again, it's mostly reprint material that you're throwing together for the company. So why wouldn't they have expanded that? Because now they know, oh, we could sell however many of these to these comic book stores that have suddenly popped up across the nation.
Right.
But in fact, the format kind of gave way to the opposite format, which is the real inheritor of the tabloid, their place in history, is the digest.
Yeah, yep.
So, yeah, and of course, as you might imagine, I have a full collection of all the digests.
Yeah.
Because I love those too.
So do I, yeah. I have to ask, did you ever have any of the Rudolphs? Did you ever want one of those?
I've got a few of them that I must have somehow inherited in one way or another, and I keep them with the same collection, but I don't prize them. So they're not very much on a pedestal for me. So, you know, whereas I can appreciate something like the oddball Welcome Back Cotter one from DC, or their Dick Tracy version.
I love that book. I love the Dick Tracy. Seems very
intriguing for them to have published that, but like, yeah, the Santa Claus and Rudolph stuff didn't, or Flintstones, was that one in there too?
Marvel did three when they had the Hanna-Barbera license. They did three Flintstones, all the Hanna-Barbera ones. So yeah, it is kind of like a weird little. It's funny you mentioned early on about how when you were collecting them in the mid '80s, you could get them for basically cover price because nobody wanted them. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was at the San Diego Comic-Con one year, and there was a guy selling the Welcome Back Cotter treasury for $50. And I thought, okay, the collector mentality has caught up with the treasuries. If people think if this guy thinks he can get $50 for the Welcome Back Cotter treasury, obviously these books have become, you know, beloved to more than just diehard nerds like myself, because $50 for that is ridiculous, you know. Luckily, I already owned it at the time. So before we get to, you know, your part of the treasury history, your role in bringing these books back. Sorry about that.
Okay.
I'll start over with my question.
Did you hear me the whole time?
Yes, I did.
Oh, perfect. Okay, yeah, great. I'll keep doing that. I'll keep talking through just so I make sure.
Yeah, no problem at all. So, yeah, before we get to your history, your role in the treasury format, I do have to play this little bit of a fantasy game here where what is there any material from the Golden Age or the Silver Age or the Bronze Age of comics that you would have wanted to have seen be a treasury, and they never got around to it? And the one that every time I ever talk about this topic is I'm always heartbroken that the X-Men Teen Titans crossover by
That's a good one to focus on.
It was right after the Treasuries went out, and that book was a regular. And Walt, who would not want Walt Simonson in a Treasury size? That book, it always breaks my heart that they never did that at the larger size.
Well, you think about it, like when George Perez did come around eventually to finish the JLA Avengers crossover, they put it out in the new fancy version of the Treasury format, which was now this absolute hardcover thing that would, you know, sell to a lot less people, obviously, because of its expense. But they reprinted his pencils from the aborted project from the mid-'80s.
Right.
And that itself, at the larger size, gives you that sense of, oh, yeah, this too would have been something perfect for that format. And it does feel like this enormous step down, that like when you went from the Hulk-Batman crossover, there was just a hint of the wider world that could have been expanded into, and just felt like, what? How are people not seeing the worth of this? Now, when you're getting into even talking about my work with what I would focus on, there is almost like I have to kind of throw myself on the mercy of the court to say I myself wouldn't take the format into the direction of where I wanted to see it as a fan, as a collector in that time period. Like, I wanted to see epic stuff that had loads of characters and all this crazy stuff going on, throw in the kitchen sink with every conceivable character or, you know, famous comic stuff put in that large format. I focused on a different directive with my stuff, and I have an excuse for that, but in a way, I let down what me as a young fan would have really wanted.
So you would have wanted to see some sort of huge, you know, Donnybrook kind of thing of all these characters mashed up together in that format?
Absolutely. And then friends of mine who would be honest and give me critique of the work I was doing at that time between the years 98 through 2003, they would say, yeah, why didn't you do that kind of thing? Why were you doing these single character focused things? And they didn't understand what my drive was, but then I was also kind of responding to a sense of superhero glut at the time that, one, I had just completed two projects back-to-back, Marvels and Kingdom Come, which had a feast of superheroes with epic content and, you know, almost taking everything cranked up to 11, where, you know, here was my version of Crisis on Infinite Earths illustrated out for a 200-page storyline. And so I wanted to kind of push back against the marketplace that seemed to be more and more focused on how much crap could you throw in to these stories. That in a way, I had already done that creatively, and I would have loved to have done that for this tabloid format, but now I was trying to steal the purpose of the tabloid format, which I saw as being a way to reach out and get a broader number of people who wouldn't look at a traditional comic book and ever open it up. But they might take this thing that looks friendly and inviting as this big object. You know, that's why when I designed the covers for the series of tabloid books, it was all these big faces of the superheroes with a consistent lettering style that itself was meant to be both Art Deco and elegant and kind of both in your face but also restrained. And when we had the growing bookstore market that was now allowing for a greater amount of comics trades into, you know, there was always like a shelf of comic-specific product, which it took all the 90s to get to that point where that had really expanded. And a lot of that work that was changing that was coming from DC Comics really building that relationship with the bookstores and showing them the greater economy of what that stuff would sell for them that they had been missing out on. You know, so we started to get more of that stuff made. And my books, whenever they got released in comic stores, they went directly into the bookstores. There was no waiting for them to be compiled later into a trade. Mm-hmm. It was itself its own 60-page trade that now, when they would rack it, would have to be on the very top.
Yes, yes.
So when you saw it in the bookstore, it would grab your attention for the average person who went by that area, and you might have had that moment of going, oh, big head of Batman. Huh. Why don't I pick that up and flip through it? And that was my goal, is part of the goal, was grabbing people in that way. In the comic stores, people are wired a certain way and didn't want you to mess with the thing that most, you know, most everybody wanted to collect a certain way and fit into a certain size of box and or bag. And, you know, even though there was answers for all of that, you know, in terms of the bags and boards and, you know, where you could store something in your own home, nobody really wanted to make room for it, which seemed really weird to me of like, I can't be the only 20-something at that point who grew up with this stuff that doesn't want more of it, that hasn't missed it.
Mm-hmm.
But it did seem like there was a resistance from the men who controlled all the major comic stores who would complain directly to DC about, why are you letting him do this?
Well, okay, that's I need to wind back a little bit. Like, how did all that get started? Where was this original notion of doing these stories like this, these sort of one and dones featuring these four iconic characters, and then of course the two subsequent Justice League editions, but then to do them at all, and then to do them in that format? I mean, where did that begin?
Well, I was yearning for the oversized format from the beginning of my career, I'm sure. And there, you know, since I was collecting all that stuff as a teenager, and then ultimately wanting the work that I was doing that was so detailed with pages for the comic stuff like Marvel's and Kingdom Come, the feeling that it was all being shrunk down to the size where you had to look really hard in the printing to be able to make out those things I was cramming into panels, felt like, you know, a missed opportunity, that something was being lost. And so I'd been yearning for the format. And then, weirdly enough, the real inspiration for starting off with Superman, before I got into a whole four-part thing that was based around who I felt were the most key DC character icons that they owned, you know, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Captain Marvel, I was first focused on Superman. And I thought, actually, following my collaboration with the two main writers I worked with, Busick and Wade, that I would actually illustrate an unprinted story finished in 1940 by Jerry Siegel for Superman.
Wow.
And this was something that Mark Wade turned me on to right as soon as we started working together back around 1994. It was the script that, you know, was illustrated by Joe Shuster, and some of the pages are printed in Steranko's History of Comics, where this story introduced K-Metal, which would become identified as Kryptonite, for the very first time before it did make it in the comics, I think, a couple more years later. And it also had the culmination in the tale of his identity having to be exposed to Lois Lane, where the result of that story was they would be Confederates in his overall goals, that they would work together and she would be intimate to his secret identity. And and so this would have been an enormous game changer.
Yeah.
That DC's editorial clearly recognized at that point in time would have screwed up a certain kind of status quo that they wanted to keep for decades still to come. Like, why screw up this whole three-person love triangle thing? And that would have been 1940, before they had gotten their first adaptation into theaters with the Fleischer cartoons, mm-hmm. or the live-action stuff that would happen with Kirk Allen. I mean, it's interesting to see it from the history perspective of they were probably right, but what was interesting from the writer's perspective was moving things forward, continuing the idea that your character's evolving, growing, and you're just taking the story to its next natural evolution. And so it becomes symbolic in a way of evolution frozen, that comic characters have always been kind of you know, identified for, is
yeah.
not having that ability to grow and really change, which is something I both love and critique within the medium. I've mm-hmm. gotten to work on stories like Kingdom Come and Earth X where I jumped ahead to, well, what if all this stuff changed? What if things grew and changed and aged? It's fun to play in that place, but then in my heart, I like these things as these preserved kind of icons that stay unmessed with. And so what ultimately happened is that I started to float this idea around to some people about the idea of my painting in this format for DC and my doing that particular kind of story. And the encouragement I got from friends was that I would be better off with my time suited for a more modern kind of thing, that doing the real retro thing, which was something I yearned for, something set in the 40s, wasn't going to be the best use of my time, arguably, that it would not reach or appeal to the most people, and that the writing style for what Jerry wrote in 1940 wasn't exactly as customer-friendly for the modern audience. So it got me thinking about the narrative I wound up doing of basically Superman and the whole trying to feed the world business that Peace on Earth did. And even in my journey to getting there, I was reaching resistance to my own crafting of the story, where I was basically being told, you're not a writer. And I wasn't being given much of a encouragement at that point from the likes of the Superman editor and key person at DC, which was Mike Carlin, who kind of upon reading my own take on the origin of Superman that I, which is only two pages that I illustrated and did some mock-up copy for, he critiqued that enough to with a sense of like, I don't know. I don't think we would want to greenlight this as a whole project based upon whatever my credit was with the two series I had done for them at that point, Uncle Sam and Kingdom Come. I was hoping that credit would be applied to pretty much anything I wanted to do.
Right.
But getting to write the whole thing myself at this point, even though I had co-plotted both of the other projects that did well for them, they weren't going to give me that rope. I could tell. I was going to have to go through, you know, writers can get really bludgeoned about with the way that they're evaluated when you're trying to break in the business. Because it's not as easy to immediately judge as when you look at the aesthetics of art. You know, you can kind of immediately look at an image and go, okay, I know whether or not that's working, whereas writers can get really, to get in, it's extremely hard. You know, if I hadn't had this sort of throwaway thought of, well, I just met Paul Dini last year and we got along pretty well, and, you know, threw my friend into his hat in the ring, and that kind of salvaged the entire thing. So then we were off and running, basically bringing my storyline, for at least the first one, into being. But I was working with Paul Marvel style, which is something that maybe we didn't do to the best application of it, but basically outside of an outline that he wrote, I broke it down to all the pages, all the pacing, everything you saw image-wise was never directed by how he would lay out. He didn't lay out any pages for me. He didn't tell me these, you know. So that's what happened with all of the oversized books that we did. I basically blocked all those in myself. And by the last one, when I was done waiting for Paul to get around to even writing outlines for me, I just blocked out the entire thing in one, like, 24-hour period where I said, this is the story I wanted to do, brought it back to him, and more or less thrust it on him, said, here it is, and, well, eventually he went along with it and dialogued it. So it's not a perfect process working that way, and I know Jack Kirby did it for a number of years, but, you know, we kind of were trying to craft something different with another purpose in mind, which was the free-floating caption text that would be, again, another way to try and do an outreach to an audience that wasn't reading comic books.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
It was about trying to reach the people who would critique comics as looking comical.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could remove that thing that looks so emblematic of a comic book, the word balloon, that now you've almost got nothing to work with, that you're looking at images that are realistic, that are painted, that are not somehow, you know, something that people would pick on, as we were still dealing with so much of that prejudice that was pointed at the medium. And the entire goal of what I was doing was trying to push off all the things that would seem, you know, part of the thing of not having too many other characters and a whole explosion of context of here's all these superheroes fighting each other, or whatever, is that for the person who doesn't read comic books, they look at that as a party they're not invited to. It just seems like too much. Like, I don't know who all those people are, so that's intimidating, and I'm not going to even try and catch up with you. You know, nowadays we don't have the same prejudice as much because people are used to the idea that these various films and merchandise things, you know, are going to have things they're going to have to learn about to get the stuff. But there was this general resistance that would kind of come easy for people to go, oh, this is why I won't bother to ever look at a comic book. And I wanted to fight that.
So the narration was built in from the beginning instead of being word balloons?
Yeah, yeah. And it was also trying to make this object be kind of a hybrid between a children's storybook and a comic book.
Gotcha.
So now, that's an experiment that you could run one time and see how it did and just say, hey, great, that's nice you tried that. But I wound up doing it four times in a row. And nobody wanted me to do that except me. So it was sort of the weird thing of DC had kind of made this, you know, commitment in effect without it being, there was no contract that promised I was going to get a new one every year, but it was known from the outset that I had pitched these four books without, you know, set storylines for each yet. But, you know, this was like, that was the rope they were willing to give me to hang myself with. But, you know, some of the other things that along the way I tried to pitch were shot down. Like, I wanted to create these sort of portrait books that would be taking care of some of the other characters that we weren't going to get to in the course of these things. So imagine the front face covers that I did for the four books. And now imagine I did a book that has 30 portraits in it. Of one would be, you know, a book of villains.
The villain one. I've seen your sketches for that, yeah.
Yeah, Portraits of Villainy. That's what it was going to be called. And so that would have gotten you everybody from Joker through Darkseid and whoever else that I felt deemed worthy. And of course, I was bristling at the time because my editor was saying, well, you're going to have to put Doomsday in there. And I'm like, oh, God, really? Why? Like, well, because he's one of the most famous villains DC's had in the last 10 years, and like, yeah, but he's terrible. You know, I would have those kind of, I would be a critic of what I felt was important to the history of comics. And of course, nobody would agree with me now, 20 years later, that like, no, you needed to include contemporary things. And, you know, everything I was doing in comics was kind of turning into a review of influences from my childhood, not about what was happening in the modern era that I was part of. Like, I wanted to sort of, like, yeah, that's fine. What you guys are making up over there is fine. But you know what? I want to keep reminding the readers of the core stuff.
Right.
You know, the stuff that had a lot of thought and history built into it that I felt, in some cases, was getting lost or smothered compared against the Banes and the
Right.
The Harley Quinns of the modern era.
Right.
So, yeah.
So before we get to the – because we're going to do a quick rundown of these books that you did and just to get your quick thoughts on them 20 years later. But I have to – this is my only opportunity to ever say this is – and I've read your interviews and I completely understand why Shazam got the fourth book because he was a TV star. And even though he had been out of the public consciousness for a long time, he still had a certain fame within the greater culture because of the TV show, because of the comic book. But I remember reading the press release or however it got announced that you were doing four of these. And I Aquaman is my all-time favorite character. And
oh, wow.
I remember reading the list and it was like Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Shazam, and my heart broke a little bit that day. There was never an Aquaman Treasury size book by you. And I even went so far a couple of years ago to make up a dummy cover of what that book would have looked like using one of your paintings of Aquaman, because it was like, just the fact I was like, oh, he's doing the Super Friends. The Super Friends are going to get their own treasuries. And then it was, no, Shazam instead. And I died a little that day.
Well, I mean, at least since you understand what that period of the 70s was,
yes,
you can appreciate that when DC acquired the rights or the license to do the character at that time for Shazam, they immediately elevated him,
yes,
to,
yes,
this equal status with what would be their top three primary icons, and arguably Aquaman was always teetering.
Oh, absolutely.
And the only thing that kept him at that number four level was the series of Super Friends, because,
yep,
you know, even though he had a cartoon in the late 60s and then he had a successful book during that time, it basically was that Aquaman was always kind of struggling. You know, they canceled his book, he became the lead feature in Adventure Comics. Eventually, somebody had the idea by the late 70s, you can't have too much fun, so they kill his infant child. You know, that's, by the way, the second Aquaman comic that I ever bought was the Adventure Comics, where, you know, like, I got the issue before that, and then the following issue, this wonderful little kid wearing the same costume as his dad gets murdered, and it's like, what the? This can't be real. They're not committing to this, are they? This guy's on a cartoon. And I was crestfallen. That's why, in effect, the final book that we did, the Liberty and Justice one, was focused more strongly on giving a spotlight to Aquaman in that book. I mean, I hope it's noticeable, but I was trying to make it distinctive that Aquaman was a bit of a stronger lead in it. They got bigger moments to sort of show off the fact that part of his thing is he's really strong. So things you think of Superman doing, he could punch through a steel wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a strong guy. And as well, I had a model who, somebody I'd met, who had both the look and the physique of the character. It just seemed like it was a perfect kind of thing to get this guy connected into my world, where, like, if I just get a, and I actually had a somebody made costumes for me for a lot of my live models. So he was wearing a full Aquaman costume when he posed.
And, wow.
You know, so I had full costumes for all of those main cast members at that time for my models to wear and do the photography from. But in that case, yeah, Aquaman was somebody I had my eyes on, including all the way from this series then to the one, the traditional comic series I did after this, Justice,
right,
where the first issue was focused around Aquaman as a lead subject. And to me, that was kind of trying to honor a sense of giving him, plus, you know, when you loved Aquaman from our childhoods back 50 years ago to what happened to him in the 90s, you may have felt that it was a very haircut interpretation of the character, where everything about him had to be run through a blender, and now he was suddenly the pirate superhero with the beard and the hair and the hook and the, you know, shirtless
metal
thing.
It
just felt like it was responding to all this sort of either indifference or antagonism that was addressing classic simple concepts before. And so the effort that I was going to put in graphically was going to try and make a case for, you know, he wasn't broken. It was just about the way you were presenting him. You know, if you go back to the 1970s when Jim Aparo, at his height, was doing those Adventure Comics appearances for Aquaman, that was a great-looking book and a,
yes,
great-looking character.
Yes.
You know, so, and of course, before then, the stuff that Nick Carty had done, as well as Ramona Fredon, you know, that stuff's fantastic.
Yeah.
And so he had a great artistic legacy, but there was this cynicism, probably mainly based around the cartoon usage of Super Friends, where you had a generation of people going like, why do I even know who he is? But yet, if you were a Marvel reader, you never questioned how cool Namor was, mm-hmm. because he was just, you know, it was more than just some undersea guy. He was a terrorizing character. He had a ton of attitude and cool distinctiveness. And this is a guy who wore nothing. And I grew up with him as one of my favorite superheroes. So I wanted to give Aquaman kind of the due that I felt he was robbed of, particularly in the 90s. And, of course, that led all the way to, you know, having a single director decide that when he was going to approach the entire DC pantheon of the Justice League, that, like, hey, you know that 90s stuff? That really looked cool. And here we are back to that again.
Yeah.
So everything that you and I might have cared about, it all gets thrown out again, and maybe it'll keep cycling back and forth and over and over again.
I do need to say, and because this is the opportunity I'm going to have to tell you this directly, and this is something that I have said for many years, so I'm not just saying it because, you know, I'm here, and I'm here talking to you. That image of Aquaman from Liberty and Justice, the full-page shot of him on the whale with the harpooners, that is my single favorite image of Aquaman of all time. Jim Aparo is my favorite comic book artist, and he is my favorite. He is my favorite. He did my favorite run of Aquaman. But if I had to boil everything that I love about the character into a single image, it is that page that you did. It is that. I love that thing. I've always joked about that. If I was a gazillionaire, I would hunt down that original and buy it, because it is. It is just everything I love about Aquaman in one single shot.
And I hope that whoever did purchase that artwork years ago, which would have been, 15, 18 years ago now, that they didn't take this, what was a double-page spread, and literally cut the two in half so they could try and make a profit by selling the two separately.
No, I don't know.
It actually happened. There's a spread in this book that has the four Super Friends characters together in Batman's cave, where they're in front of his monitor screens. And that was an actual spread. It's a single piece of art. But since I treated it as two comic pages, where there was no interlocking image that connected across, I know exactly who bought it from me, and I know exactly what they did. They wound up trying to flip it for, a higher price by selling two separate images. And so my art dealer had to wind up telling people who had purchased it that this was actually a compromised piece of art that basically was butchered. Somebody carefully went in there with an X-Acto blade and split two things that used to be one into two. And things like that happen in comics history all the time. But this is one where just the greed was such a striking thing that destroyed, you get the idea.
Oh, that breaks my heart. Oh, my God. All right, so, okay.
And there's a million of those stories. So.
Oh, man. So, okay, as we talked about, we're going to just do a very brief kind of rundown of these books that you did. I just want to get your thoughts of how you feel about them 20 years later. So let's start with Superman Peace on Earth. I mean, how do you feel about it now? What do you like about it? Do you think it holds up the way you hoped it would 20 years later?
Well, not any single thing I did is going to always feel like it holds up, because I can either notice problems when I look at the printing of it, or I can tell graphically what things I didn't do as well as I either was capable then or what I'm capable of now. I only see the defects. I see things where I was working maybe, like I look at all these pages and things seem paler than they should have been to me. Like I didn't go in there with greater darkness and depth with the stuff. But then again, you know, I killed myself with certain things, like Superman speaking to Congress, you know, was a complicated thing of, you know, putting all those different figures in there, which ironically as a photo shoot was me separately shooting all these shots of my model for Superman throughout the whole book. I shot him in one go. But then I had one single friend of mine who was actually posed for me for the photographer in Marvels. I had him come over and shoot just different shots of men sitting with different expressions, with his hand, with his, you know, crossing his arms, whatever. And so it's only one person who I was looking at reference of to fill the entire room. So what I wound up doing was just altering those faces to fit different types of people. Mm-hmm. But it was really only one person who posed for me. So little things like that would happen throughout the book. That is my most successful of these tabloids. In fact, the orders that happened with that one book would never be mirrored with the ones that would follow. Basically, just getting into the nuts and bolts of what comics used to sell, you know, I was able with both series like Marvel's and Kingdom Come to sell over 200,000 copies of each individual issue, which was good and competitive in that time period, even though you have things that sold 400,000 to 500,000 copies. Those are still really good high numbers. And so by the time that this one tabloid was done, retailers supported it more aggressively, I mm-hmm. think, with the beginning of it. And so it sold 100,000 copies, but each one thereafter sold less. So, like, you wouldn't think Batman would be the step down.
No.
Arguably a more popular character. That sold only 60,000.
Wow.
And then with Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel, those would then sell in the 50s, I believe. And even by the time I did the Justice League, where I thought, okay, well, this is going to shoot it right back up again, it was still, I think it topped out around 60. So there was kind of this sense from not necessarily what I was sure that the market could bear in terms of what collectors would buy. And again, each individual person could tell me why, what they thought of it or whether or not they would have bought it. But really given the sense that the retail community had kind of said, yeah, we're not going to order as much of this as we would a traditional comic book.
Hmm.
Like, everybody was telling me the same thing. And at DC Comics, I had their person, Bob Schreck, always telling me the complaints they was regularly getting from these people. And that had some measure of impact because they had his ear and he would pass it directly on to me. And it was weird because there was a stodgy kind of, you know, you remember the kind of person who opened up comic stores back 40 some years ago? You know, they weren't always the most agreeable and
really,
they weren't the most kid friendly of sorts, you know, a lot of old hippies, but a lot of malcontents. We had quite a few of them here in Chicago, I know. And I met most of them before they clicked out of the business. But, yeah, so, I mean, in a way, those were the people judging how well this entire project could do across the country, you know. So, in a way, there wasn't the support I would have hoped for. But that's probably not the insight you wanted to hear me
content. I'm fascinated by all of it because, I mean, you know, I've mentioned on other shows, I have the display box that DC produced for these books specifically, and they came with individual headers drawn by you of all the different books. And I mean, to me, it's like I would think that DC, it seems to me, just from my uninformed opinion from the outside, that DC did as much as they could marketing-wise to get people involved in these things. And it's a shame to hear that on the retail level, at least from comic book dealers, they just – it was just the size, and they just weren't interested. That's heartbreaking.
And that's actually – that's what I felt too. I was not critical of DC's support of the project. In fact, on top of the way they would advertise each one of these coming out once a year,
yeah,
there was also Wizard Magazine, which was the internet before. You know, they would do strong support of each of the volumes with an article focused on each one. They would give me usually a cover feature. You know, I would do a cover commission for them to help promote my – end of the year book. And it was my way of also not disappearing for what seemed like 2 years with each one of these things that I had done before, where, you know, a 200 page book that's going to come out, you know, like Marvel's or Kingdom Come is going to come out over a 4 month period. But yet I had to put my life on hold for a year and a half
right.
to 2 years
right.
to get that work done. And when people talk about the pandemic and being quarantined, it's like, that's what I lived like all the time, and particularly working on one of those kind of things where you really felt like the world was leaving you behind because you weren't getting stuff out there that people were interacting with regularly. So I thought if I could increase that visibility where not just from the covers I did with various series I was committed to, which was not many back at that time, that I had one book a year you could get from me that would be focused around a prime superhero that everybody knew. There was both support and kind of ambivalence from like, yeah, we'd rather see you drawing Kingdom Come again. Mm-hmm. And that was what I got generally from people who were more honest with me, as opposed to, you know, at a signing when I might see people annually. I got plenty of nice support from fans, but nobody's going to stand in line just to get a chance to tell you, hey, you know, you really ought to be doing something else. You know,
hopefully not.
But one of the best quotes I had from somebody who was giving me their sort of dismissive opinion was Rob Liefeld, who I didn't have a ton of contact with, but back in 1999, I think he had told me, yeah, I know, we're going to get your end-of-the-world gift to America, but, you know, that's, you know, like, he was dismissing it as your wonderful gift to the world, but yet nobody wants that from you. They want something else from you.
Hmm.
And that's what I was getting from. Some fans, and I get it, because I can see it through the prism of looking at what maybe if I had done each volume was Superman versus Shazam or, you know, these big epic events, but in a way it felt like the comics publishing game had been nothing but that constantly.
Right.
So I was trying to provide the contrast. That's why if you look at just moving on from the Superman one to the Batman one, one of the things that was distinctive for me in that is that I was stripping away everything additional heaped upon Batman that you could imagine. And that includes the car, the sidekicks, the high displays of wealth and the accoutrements that are more fantastical. That basically it was kind of a guy with a rope, some tools, and a stealth-like ability to get around and get to places that others couldn't. And that if you're going to overthink the whole Batman thing, the second he's displaying his tank car, you're giving up that, like, well, I guess it's a millionaire who's Batman, right? Or he's funded by them, you know, whereas the guy who's doing so much with so little is harder to pin down as to who this might be.
Hmm.
You know, to me, that seemed more logical, and it's one of those things I wanted to kind of get back to. But then again, a big part of that story was focused around the idea of, if you're really having a war on crime, isn't that something that's got to delve into the issue of economic disparity and
Yes. Where
does crime emerge from?
Yeah.
And so there's kind of a hardness of seeing images, as even Bruce Timmitt said to me, like, you're showing Batman beating up black people. That's not something I want to see in a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it. But that was part of the aggressiveness that I wanted the book to take on the issues that are at the heart of this crisis in at least America when it comes to the haves and the have-nots. You know, in effect, the story itself winds up being a reverse Robin origin story where
Right. Here's
a kid who's orphaned like he is, and his immediate action isn't to suddenly take him into his own home and make him his child. And it raises concerns over, like, what if Batman walks away from a kid who suffered as he did? It's not meant to be the most comfortable of stories, but it's meant to kind of try and take these things on. Also, by the way, the way in which Batman's colorful adversaries that I skipped aside from showing them quite so colorfully.
You show the Joker, but his face isn't towards the camera. I thought that was such an interesting touch.
Yeah, that basically a majority of them are all in here, even including Harley Quinn, who I have working as a waitress at a diner. You know, that was done consciously with the idea that he is surrounded by these people who lead these lives that go into these certain extremes. But taking a step back, the Riddler is just some guy who's not necessarily always wearing this colorful outfit and so on. And actually, one of the oddest deep cut kind of cameos in here is a guy who's holding a knife against a woman's throat is my version of the original Clayface, the Basil Carlo.
Oh, wow. I got to go back and look at that now. Okay.
But and by the way, all the young men who are seen as criminals here throughout the book were students of my art school who I went and asked to pose for me in multiple trips that I would make into the city. And these are all people who were, you know, embarking upon a hopeful career of working in illustration and everything. So these poor guys have to be getting kicked in the face by Batman here, and you know, but they were lovely to work with. So and my model for Batman the entire time, even though I had gotten this costume made for him and he had posed for me as Batman in Kingdom Come, he suddenly decided at this point in his life he was going to grow a goatee. So virtually all the photographs I was working from here, I had to remove facial hair. And the thing is, he didn't keep the goatee either, so it was
a weird kind of, you know.
I've had to do that with my Superman model. He had a beard most of the time I worked with him on Kingdom Come, but around the time I worked with him on Peace on Earth, I was able to get him to cleanly shave.
The thing that I really liked about Batman War on Crime was that I liked some of the more sort of adult thematic elements to it. One was that moment you talked about with Harley Quinn as the waitress, where I liked the idea that Batman is checking up on people that he's arrested. And he has that line about, you know, the crushing drudgery of her daily life is probably going to send her back into crime. And I, you know, in the Batman world, everything is very black and white. You know, there's the good guys and the bad guys. But I love the gray of this world is that Batman is sympathetic, that there are people who want maybe to go straight, but find their life circumstances so impossible that it's going to make them be criminals again. And I thought that was a very sophisticated view of people who go into crime for a Batman comic book.
And the thing is it didn't feel like at that time, at least from what was being published throughout the 90s, that we were getting much of that sentiment
right.
coming across. So there was the goal of like trying to get past all the flamboyance of supervillains and the ridiculous things that he was always set against and get into like what really gave birth to this character or even the vigilante hero concept. And so, you know, we were really ambitious to try and connect that in a way that, you know, we knew wasn't necessarily going to be perfectly successful in terms of the way it reached an audience, because we're not using enough of the flamboyant stuff to really attract you, but we're hoping that grounding it in a sense of realism more than you were generally used to, maybe in some ways the most similar to what David Mazzucchelli did with Frank Miller,
mm-hmm.
you know, that year one storyline was probably the closest to what we were trying to go for. And I'm sure that David Mazzucchelli would not want to be compared to me in any particular way, since I'm not the particular kind of draftsman that he would find appealing, but who knows.
Well, you talk about flamboyant. That was the other thing I wanted to mention was I love the ending of this book is that after he talks about this boy, this young boy that he's helped steer out of a life of crime, and it ends in that moment where he's in the – I believe he's in the cemetery. And Batman is just – it's like dawn and he's just sort of sitting there and he talks about how there's a piece – a piece inside of his heart that this young boy is going to have, and it's going to lead him on a better life. And he says, maybe someday I'll feel that and I'll be able to give up my mission. But until then, I must wait. And I thought it was one of the most melancholy endings of a Batman story I've ever seen, of this guy just sitting there by himself in the middle. You know, it's like 5 a.m. in the morning, and he knows he can't quit, even though he desperately sort of wants to. And you're talking about that flamboyance. I mean, every Batman story feels like it has to end with him swinging on the rope, you know, da-da, you know, like some big moment. And instead, it ends on this quiet little thing. And I really found that quite touching. And I didn't think I think it was possible for me to be touched anymore by a Batman story because I've read so many of them. But I really like that you guys found a new kind of angle on that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. And that's certainly, wonderful. You know, that was the dream, that we would hopefully have those things that would connect for people on a deep emotional level. And that's the kind of writer that Paul is, too.
Right,
he's
right.
very skilled at finding the heart of things. You know, it's hard to get through blocking out a story with him without tears coming forth. So,
mm-hmm.
and so, I mean from him.
Yeah, okay. So the next one was Shazam Power of Hope. Now, I have to ask you, did you get much pushback from DC about the wanting it to be Shazam? I mean, did they kind of like, really, that's him? Or were they on board with that?
Not once. No. And I have to think, let's see, this is 2000 when this came out. So the year before Wonder Woman's, you know, everybody was getting a book on their 60th anniversary here. And although that was one thing I had no cooperation from DC on, there was no effort they were willing to make to draw a correlation for the 60th. They had zero interest in it, even though there was this book program that happened with Chronicle Books regarding, you know, the three main characters getting a history book at that time. Even those things didn't themselves have some big sign saying 60 years. So, you know, 15 years later, when they did big events and promotion based around the 75th anniversary of their characters, I felt I was no longer working with the company, but I definitely felt like, oh, how come that's okay? What the heck? You know, I had this whole program that was entirely my own, and it felt like, you know, it was the right time to do this. How can you not take advantage of 60 years? But there was a prevailing attitude that their characters were viewed with criticism of being, you know, your father's superhero. They were just too old, and you don't want to draw too much attention to that. But what I liked about the period I was able to work here, and this, it had not been so utterly redefined as to have their essential histories really preserved. Like Wonder Woman's origin was still that she was sculpted out of clay. Captain Marvel was still, you know, Captain Marvel, as well as, you know, he was the singular boy that had been found by the wizard named Shazam and such. So I didn't have to fight against too much. Like, the worst change for me of having to retell the origins, or even something I would have liked to have included, the origin of Superman, where I kind of hid the classic style of the Superman rocket in the first shot. The one thing I would have liked to have included is a panel that showed a baby holding up the crib. And that was one thing that was forever changed by the John Byrne re-envisioning of his history, where he could no longer have superhuman abilities when he was underage.
They developed later on,
So that was the one compromise that kind of had to drop out. Because otherwise, my retelling of his origin is so much a tribute to that original two-page spread that Schuster drew that, you know, showed those kind of key cornerstone events. And I would have included that one as just one of those iconographic images. Like, everybody remembers the whole thing of the baby holding up the crib. How could you not want to see that? And, you know, so stuff like that would be, you know, slight tweaks that I would have to sidestep, you know. But for the most part, everything else, you know, I wasn't losing out on anything from the origins or just the general contours of the characters being. Like in the case of the Wonder Woman book, you'll notice she never flies in the entire graphic novel, because that's what, it made no sense. Why would Amazons fly? But yet that's a power they gave her post-crisis. And even then, I don't remember when, how it was introduced that she suddenly had the ability to fly, unlike all the other Amazons. It's a whole complicated thing that gets lost to time, and now it's just that we accept, oh yeah, of course, she's like Superman. Why?
She's got that cool plane, you know? Come on.
Right, and I wanted to get back to the cool plane, which I just thought, like, how do you get rid of one of her most iconographic things, which had been done no great service by the model that they showed on the television show, but, you know, conceptually, it was still a fun idea that if you dealt with it realistically, you would have to consider, well, you don't know what it looks like because invisible.
Right.
So I tried to depict that a couple times in here. I did it a couple times between different images where you're seeing her basically walk an invisible ramp up.
You see, like, the inside. Ship. You can see the inside of the plane when she's got the door open, and then but there's nothing around it. It's a really nice way of representing that.
But
I will say my favorite moment from the Power of Hope book is that moment where the doctor gives him a kiss and he gets embarrassed. And
right.
I love that so much. And I love the dialogue there where she talks about that she finds the captain to be, you know, very childlike and sweet, and that sort of, and I love that she makes that leap, not realizing she's kissing a young boy. But I love how you draw his face there, where he's just completely embarrassed by that. It's truly a great, to me, one of the great moments of the character.
But now, one of the things that I wished had made a stronger impression from the book we did, that was something Paul and I were very agreed upon, and I particularly, the wisdom of Solomon has to mean something more. It has to mean more than just your instincts are great. That in a way, he's got an enhanced brain when he's in the form of Captain Marvel. So it's not the same personality. It's like you have traded between two totally different individuals. And so Captain Marvel should never seem like an imbecile, you know. And that's the problem of his contemporary treatment is that, oh, isn't it fun, the idea of a kid inside the body of a man? Like, I guess it's fun, but that's never what he was. That was not the true heart of it. In a way, that transformation into the cool superhero was never hobbled by the idea that he should walk around acting like either an obnoxious teenager or a very immature 10-year-old transformed into this. And one of the things I wanted to get at is the idea that Billy had these experiences that aged him prematurely, and he was living beyond his age in terms of his behavior and what he took on himself. Like, he had a job.
Yeah,
and
yeah. He's a little kid with a full-time job.
He lived in an apartment by himself that he was able to get squared away by just taking on the other identity get the apartment, you know, paid for. But and then the craziest thing, the thing that was the most fun for me, is establishing the idea that he answered Captain Marvel's fan mail himself.
Mm-hmm.
And here he would get this enormous sack of mail that instead of calling upon the might, the strength of Captain Marvel to carry that home or fly it home, he carries this entire sack, which was proportionately large and literally impossible for a 12-year-old kid his size to carry up a flight of stairs or anywhere, frankly. That's where the comic part comes in. But, you know, the idea that in a way he's got this maturity that really we wanted to come across in the story is like the man is in Billy, you know, the man is already there. He's more man as a child than he is child in the man's body. And of course, we've not had any reverberation of that. You either come up as a Captain Marvel fan of old, where you kind of identify things that way, or you're more a child of the modern era, where you think that that's the way to write him. And it's all the fault of Tom Hanks.
Oh, okay. Right from Big.
Yeah. Ever since that movie came out, Roy Thomas was the first writer to put it into a series, to approach it that way. And subsequently, every single other writer, with the exception of Jeff Smith, who's taken on the character, has approached him with the thought that that means that you should be writing him as if he's just a big, dumb guy.
Right.
And I believe it's wrecked the character.
Hmm.
And I don't – it's the tough thing of, like, there's no fixing it at this point. Now that it's in a movie,
yeah. Oh,
it is,
yeah.
What it is.
That's the version everybody's going to know. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is – so something I got to do like this here is frozen in time. It becomes a representation of – you know, it'll never be reclaimed because you can't fix what the general public thinks is what it is.
Right.
You know, there's no putting that genie back in the bottle.
Right. The thing I love about the, you know, if in these books that you had done, if you had said that in the Peace on Earth universe, there's only Superman, it would have made sense because this seems like a more realistic world that maybe doesn't have a million superheroes in it. But I loved it when Superman showed up because then I was like, oh, all four of these books kind of exist in their own little Paul Dini, Alex Ross universe, which I just enjoyed. I was like, oh, okay, they can cross-pollinate with each other, and I found that very charming.
But, you know, one of the things, too, with that is that in the time we were working on these things, there was nothing in those first four books that denied any of the current continuity.
Right, right.
There was no aesthetic character, no aesthetic details about the characters that I had completely thrown out what was being done by all the other artists. I just avoided the things that I didn't necessarily want to showcase. So, like, if I didn't want to show Wonder Woman flying, well, seeing her leap from one thing to another, leap through a window, you wouldn't immediately say, well, he's denied her ability to fly. You know, none of that really demanded any changes. So the real separation comes by doing the Justice League stuff, bridging off of it, where at that point, what gets, again, lost to time is that both Barry Allen and Hal Jordan were definitely dead, and Aquaman was heavily worked over. And, yeah, this was a whole different landscape of the way the characters were done. You know, one anecdote I think it would be interesting for you to hear related to the tabloids is that the tabloid for the Justice League that, you know, again, only got one done for them back then, it was reprinting just those Mike Sekowski stories from
right.
back then,
right.
Had an enormous impact on me, not just from being one that I had when I was about 9 or 10 years old, but the fact that there was that double-page spread included of everybody on the satellite done by Dick Giordano. In that lineup, you had characters that I didn't fully understand their relationship or history with the team.
Mm-hmm.
So there was Metamorpho.
Right, right.
And there was Zatanna wearing her pre-70s, you know, readjusted time outfit where she's still wearing the old Magician's performing outfit. And so I was actually most influenced by that as to who I saw as the prime lineup of the team. And even though Firestorm was inducted by 78, I think, into 70, the lineup.
79, I think, right at the beginning.
Oh, was it
79?
Okay. So for me, he didn't make the cutoff because he wasn't in that spread. He was neither on the Super Friends cartoon show. To me, the newest members of the team were indicated by either Zatanna or by Red Tornado, who were both fixtures of the 70s. And it's almost like I didn't fully grasp this character, as much as I like him enough from that period. It almost felt like he was the new era, the 80s, was represented by his coming in, and everything would be different after he had joined the team, because he was basically a Peter Parker prototype
yes,
added
yes.
to that lineup. So when people could wonder, well, why did you include this, this, and this character, but you didn't include Firestorm? There's the reason, the logic of it. But then again, even in this moment of, okay, what discerns exactly the version of the team you're presenting here, you'll notice that I always show Aquaman with his infant son.
Yes.
You know, I established twice in here moments where you see him with the child, and I was trying to save his soul, his life, in effect, in comics, that I always saw that as a horrific event that never should have been greenlit. And, of course, weirdly enough, the guy I was technically working for, Paul Levitz, was the one who greenlit it in the first place for the character getting killed.
Right.
He told the writer that Aquaman needed that sort of kick in the pants to make his series have more juice or more of a, you know, more whatever drama to kick it up. And so then I think that Steve Skeets wrote that, and then they drew it in, and then quickly.
I believe it's David Michelinie, actually, who actually
really?
literally wrote the story where he dies, yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah.
Well, then, yeah, I mean, I don't think it did the job they wanted it to, because he wound up getting bounced out of, Adventure Comics stopped being his lead feature comic and turned into that huge anthology
yep.
where he was just one of the various stories that populated the anthology.
Yep.
And so in my eyes, he kind of stopped being a lead character when that happened. And anyways, it's just, it's one of those things I always thought I regretted their doing. And, but even, you know, in 1977, 78, when that occurred, you know, they did stuff like killing Iris Allen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there's all these sort of bloody things that started to happen because the company was feeling this pinch of not having their heroes have enough sense of drama or loss in their lives. They almost felt like they were too happy and settled, so they needed to throw in the complication that would reflect a lot of the complication in the world. And so therefore you had this alteration that I was just getting introduced to this stuff at this point in my life, and I hated seeing it fall apart immediately upon my introduction to it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, at least, you know, somebody like Gwen Stacy was killed when I was 3 years old, so I had to kind of adjust to that, too.
Right, it's grandfathered in at that point, yeah.
It was grandfathered in, but, you know, it's, yeah, so I was in my own way trying to repair the DC continuity that I was just getting used to and feeling was almost trying to fight the nature of Marvel storytelling style that was never DC's strength.
Right,
and they were trying, you know, they were bringing the writers over from Marvel to try and head up DC's books and change things around, and it felt like DC was itself kind of a different animal that they didn't fully appreciate what was good about it, or maybe I'm just ignorant that they had to change, they needed to change, and as a sensitive little kid, I just thought, we don't need to do that.
Yeah,
The fact that this guy was married or that guy had a kid, and, you know, why do you got to kill that person off? What the hell's that good for?
Yeah, I've said for decades that I loved all comic books, but DC was always my favorite because as a kid, I wanted to live in that world. I didn't want to live in the Marvel world because it seemed kind of angry. The Marvel, I want to hang out in a satellite with all these people because it looks really cool. That was what I was excited about. And that leads us perfectly to talking about the final books here, Secret Origins and Liberty and Justice, because I never missed an issue of Justice League. It was my favorite comic growing up, even when I was grounded and punished by my parents for various indiscretions. I always got Justice League. I never missed it. I have a complete collection of the book. And Liberty and Justice is one of my all-time favorite Justice League stories. It should have been a movie. They should have just made it a movie. I mean, it's got the scope of a movie. You've got all these great character beats. I love that Batman manages to sneak in to the Pentagon without Martian Manhunter discovering him with his mind power. He's like, you managed to keep yourself hidden from me. How do you do that? Batman doesn't answer. I love all that stuff. I just think you guys just did such a great job of transforming what you had built, which were these four stories that purposely seem a side universe, a pocket universe where there's real world issues. And now it's a little more comic booky, but yet it still really worked. And of course, Secret Origins is kind of like a picture book all on its own.
You know, the actual plot for this, I mean, it's probably obvious to any old film fan who reads this, but like the real inspiration for the storyline in the Justice League book was the one where the germs break out. It's much like a film about a pandemic. The Andromeda Strain.
Oh, the Andromeda Strain, of course. Because they even have the same suits, even.
Yeah, and the thing is that I was very impressed with that film when I saw it as a teenager because it seemed so grounded and real and everything. And, of course, it really felt like the most practical version of meeting an alien life form, which at that point is just, you know, microscopic. But the idea of how toxic it might be in interaction with human life. And there was a two-part Justice League storyline from the Dick Dillon era that had them facing off against these larger, more parasitic organisms that attached themselves and sort of sucked the energy from the heroes and such. So I was kind of combining the two influences to make this storyline, and the person who was the least happy with all this, maybe some fans too, but the least happy was Paul because he would complain to friends of ours about how, you know, wait a minute, how come he's working on all this fun stuff with this person or that person over here, but the thing he gets to write with me is the one where their biggest enemy is germs.
But that's what I like about it because, I mean, that's what to me keeps it as part of a piece with the previous books is that they're facing a real-world issue, not Kanjar Roe, you know? I mean, as much as I love Kanjar Roe or Starro the Conqueror, they're facing something real, very real, germs, you know? So, I mean, it's an incredibly timely, really.
Well, and also, I mean, the real thing they wind up having, you know, the greater amount of the, you know, the bonus members of the League show up for is basically how to deal with human outcry and overreaction because the virus never reaches America in the story that we did.
Right.
It's just the idea that there's a threat of it coming, that people are watching it with a weather front moving across the globe. And so then that writing and behavior that, and so in a way, the series, the one shot itself is almost like it's the Justice League versus America. You know, it winds up being that kind of storyline because I was doing this as a post 9/11 kind of commentary about how much we would overreact. And of course, in the year I'm working on this, we hadn't even entered into war yet at this point, but it was in the offing. And so it was very much a study on how we can take things too far when we let fear grip us. And that was the kind of commentary I wanted the story to embody. And weirdly enough, giving me all these sort of, you know, dramatic shots of each and every superhero character. I mean, as you mentioned, different moments that were, you know, meant to be powerful or quiet and, you know, moments of intellectual or emotional power. For me, one of those was the idea where somebody who was going to commit suicide for fear of what was coming is saved by Superman. To me, that was one that had that kind of emotional power to it that I was always aiming for. So I constructed this story in sort of a mad dash, and then Paul and I tried to beat it together into some sense of order. So it's a bit of a it's a bit of a mixed bag, but all of them have elements of that. Just this one was at least trying to. Some fans and retailers were asking, why can't you just give us a traditional comic book? So this was in response to that, and it probably wasn't satisfying enough to that edge, because as I would realize upon doing it too, that as much as people can like seeing the older versions of characters, the biggest thing that would affect readers and retailers is anything that would seem to be set in the contemporary now. That if you were creating work that would seem like it was somehow apocryphal.
Okay.
If your work is only apocryphal, then therefore it can be easily ignored. Whereas my thought was, well, when you guys have yet changed the continuity again in 5 years, this story will still remain the same and can still be sold because it's timeless to who these characters originally were.
Right.
And... well, anyways.
I think it's marvelous. Like I said, it's one of my favorite JLA stories of all time, and I've read every JLA story from 1960 through around 2010. So I've already taken up way too much of your time. So I really appreciate it, and I hate to wrap this conversation up because I could keep talking to you about treasuries forever. But I do want to end this interview with just one sort of final just let your mind be expansive. Thing. Say – Any company came to you and said, Alex, we want to do a treasury featuring whatever you want to do. It is totally tabula rasa. Don't worry about the sales part of it. What do you want to do? Is there something that you would just be dying to do if you could just – whatever character, whatever concept you would want to see in a treasury? Is there something you'd be burning to do if you were given the opportunity?
Well, I mean, aside from something that would be a completely original graphic novel that I might have my intentions or heart based around, something that would work within what people would have a very strong reaction to would be the obvious thing of seeing these two worlds mixed just like they did so, you know, concussively back 45 years ago with Superman and Spider-Man, to have a mixture of the two iconic universes crossing paths again. And who knows, maybe something like that is possible. These days, everything might be on the table with what publishers are willing to open themselves up to, particularly with the needs to try and create stuff that's going to re-energize excitement in our field.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would certainly be something I would be excited to read. That would be amazing. So, like I said, I hate to end it here, but I have taken up so much of your time. I really, really appreciate you doing this. This was just a crazy notion that I had that I might get to talk to you for an episode of Treasury Cast. And when I realized that the 50th episode was coming up, I thought, well, let me try. And it all came together quite well. And so I really appreciate all of your work. I've been a fan of yours forever. And I really appreciate you taking the time to sit here and nerd out with me about the treasuries.
thank you. It's a topic I obviously have some connection to. So.
Absolutely. All right. Well, again, thank you very much. And everyone, I want you to stay tuned. We're going to play some podcast promos. I want to come back. I'm going to do some listener feedback.
After a long day of criminal activity, there's nothing I like better than to sit down and listen to the old radio. Wait a minute. That's not a radio. It's
Plastic Man. Plastic Man.
That's right, it's the Plasticast, a brand new podcast dedicated to Plastic Man. I'm your host, Max Romero. Together, we'll be talking about Plastic Man in the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and every other age you can think of, right up to his upcoming reappearance in DC Rebirth. We'll also be talking about any Plastic Man news that might be coming up, and his appearances in every media from comics to cartoons. Whew. Makes me woozy just to think about it. I hope you'll join me to talk about the longest arm of the law here on the Plasticast. Here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Plastic Man! Plastic Man!
The Justice League wouldn't help him, so Batman formed a new team. These people of power are all looking for something, be it their past, or a purpose, or simply somewhere to fit in. These are the heroes for a troubled age. They are the Outsiders.
We are the Outsiders. Oh, we are the Outsiders.
Covering Mike W. Barr's 1983 series from the very beginning, as they face villains no other team can, like Agent Orange, the Force of July, and the Nuclear Family. Puns. This is The Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast. Look for us with The Huntress Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Or listen at our website, thehuntresspodcast.com, and follow us on Twitter at BatOutcasters. We are The Outcasters, because to live outside the law, you must be honest.
And we're back with listener feedback, and this is going to be feedback for episode 49 of Treasure Cast, which was Batman's Strangest Cases with my guest Dan Greenfield. So let's get right to the comments from the website, which is at fireandwaterpodcast.com. First up is fellow network all-star Ryan Daly, who says, point of correction, Chris and I have not covered the Brave and the Bold story with Batman and the House of Mystery. Siskoid and Martin Gray covered that story on an episode of FW Team-Up. I've already recorded a discussion on Swamp Thing number 7 that will appear on episode 29 of Midnight, the podcasting hour, so I won't say much about it beyond my agreement with everything you and Dan said about the story. I think it's perfectly fitting that the story appears in a Batman treasury because it's really a misplaced Brave and the Bold tale that was happened to be published in Swamp Thing. And on the subject of Swamp Thing knocking out Batman, somewhere in the multiverse, Guy Gardner is laughing. Yes, Ryan, thank you for that correction. I think even when I said it, I realized I was wrong, but I was just too lazy to look it up. I kind of regard Martin Gray, Siskoid, they both have the Queen on their money. What's really the difference? But anyway, thank you for that correction. Brian Linton says, you guys had me at Red Tide. As a fisheries biologist, I love me a good Red Tide tale. I even have an interesting one of my own. Actually, it's really only interesting if you find nonlinear models and fish population dynamics to be interesting, so I won't share it here. I don't know, Brian. I think we might have enjoyed it. Despite the lack of harmful, agile blooms, I also enjoyed your coverage of the other stories in this Treasury edition. The storytelling and artwork both look to be top-notch. Thank you for sharing this truly interesting collection of tales. Thank you, Brian. Captain Entropy says, sounds fascinating to me, Brian. Roll Tide. Yeah, I agree, Brian. Let's hear the Red Tide story. I think that would be fascinating. Ward Hill Terry also says, I'm interested, Brian. I was a program educator at the New England Aquarium for 13 years. So, Brian, come on. We got to get you on the show maybe to talk about some Red Tide stuff. Jay Effingham Bellwether says, Rob, the name Aloysius is pronounced Aloysius. It is the Latinized version of names like Louis, Louis, Luis, Luigi, etc. I know of no living person by this name, but it has long been a popular name for fictional Irish characters. characters. I'm sort of shocked that I misread that name, because I am familiar with the name Aloysius because there is a character in one of my all-time favorite movies of all time. It's a mad world named Aloysius. And you hear he's one of the cops that is working below Spencer Tracy. And Spencer Tracy says his name a few times. He's, oh, Aloysius and stuff. So I'm ashamed that I didn't say it right, because I'm certainly familiar with the name, if only from that movie. But anyway, thank you, Jay Effingham. Martin Gray returns. And he says, well, returns in the mentions, at least. He says, top show as ever. Dan's a great guest. That logo, Batman's, does indeed look awful. But Chris Franklin might like it. See, Nightcast. Why didn't they just call it The Strangest Cases of Batman? That cover is clever, mind. Pay for one page and get a double spread by extending the background and throwing in reprint pages. Thanks for the respect Irv Novik received this episode, as you pointed out. But the right inker, his Batman looked as creepy as anyone's. Mind, I always loved his flash work with, if memory serves, Frank McLaughlin. Yes, no problem, Art, and we're fans here of Irv Novik, so I was happy to say nice things about him. And then Chris Franklin responds to Martin's comment, where he says, no, Martin, I don't care for this logo either. Am I suddenly bad logo lover or something? Ryan and I really need to get on that logo YouTube episode. That is true, Chris. I would love to see that. I think regarding why the book wasn't called The Strangest Cases of Batman is because I think DC wants – they always want the marquee name to be the top – part of the cover, instead of having Strange Cases of Batman. They wanted to be Batman Strangest Cases. I think that's in the days when things were still published on newsstands, they probably wanted to get the character logo as close to the top as humanly possible. Captain Entropy returns to the comments, and he says, that bent column that forms the S is just a smidge too thin, and the horizontal bar part is too high. Remember, when people tell you something's wrong or doesn't work for them, they're almost always right. When they tell you exactly what they think is wrong and how to fix it, they're almost always wrong. Neil Gaiman. Given that, maybe I'm too particular. Mike Dina says, an excellent episode, gentlemen. It's always nice to hear the boss, Dan, on the podcast. And you both brought some excellent insight to this particular Treasury. The funny thing is, I don't ever remember owning a Treasury comic as a kid, but for some reason, I really remember stories from this issue. Is Batman Strange's Cases just in the zeitgeist? Were there reprints of these stories somewhere else? Red Water, Crimson Death, Nobody Knows, and A Vow from the Grave really stuck out to me as stories I remember reading, but I have no idea where or how I would have read them. As I said above, even though I never had any treasuries, I'm really enjoying this podcast series, and I can't wait to hear the next episode with Alex Ross. I really love his Shazam Power of Hope treasury. Keep up the great work. Thank you, Mike, and I hope you enjoyed this episode or my talk with Alex Ross. Chris Franklin returns and says, great episode, fellas. I remember seeing ads for this in some of my earliest comics, and I recall thinking Robin looked kind of sinister. Well, he did to three-year-old me anyway. Now I think it looks like it could have been yet another Power Records LB cover. I have never seen a copy of this in person, so I unfortunately don't own this one, although I have all the stories either in the original format or in reprints. The BTAS crew not only adapted the idea of Batman Nobody Knows into Legends of the Dark Knight, they turned A Vow from the Grave into a Killer Croc story and called it Sideshow. This is a great lineup of stories for sure, and it is really a shame DC gave up the ghost on these collections, because they were this close to cracking the code of themed trade paperbacks a good 10 years before they would even begin to appear, really. Always a pleasure to hear Dan talk Batman comics and not just read his thoughts on 13th Dimension. Looking forward to his upcoming series on the big change from residual campiness to the Creature of the Night era Batman. I'm glad you clarified Dan is one of the biggest Batman fans you know, Rob. I know of one other one. And congratulations on the big guest coming for the 50th episode, Yowza. Thank you, Chris. And again, like I said, I hope you enjoyed this interview, and Alex, that preceded this feedback segment. Captain Entropy back again, and he says, Rob and Dan, I've loved these stories for years. You two managed to do more than just agree with me about the good parts I already enjoyed, although that's important. You also found aspects I never noticed before, like Bernie Wrightson's little touches, so that now I enjoy these stories even more. This is why I listen to the Fine Wonder Network. I mean, the main reason is the comedy, but the knowledgeable insights make a respectable second-place showing. I agree 100% with your points on Batman. These portrayals of the character are far more interesting than the one-dimensional, obsessive Mary Sue of retribution we often get now. Thank you both. Thank you, Captain. Ward Hill Terry, once again. These are a lot of multiple comments from people. He says, this is one of my most reread Treasury editions. Every page is magnificent. He discussed briefly the reasons that DC abandoned this kind of book, including publisher Jeanette Kahn's aversion to reprints. That seems plausible. I started buying DC comics at just about the time Jeanette Kahn came on board. As a young collector, I learned a lot about the hobby from the letters pages in the various comics, and one of the things I gleaned was that reprints were frowned upon. Consequently, I had an early dislike for comics that offered reprints. This led me to have an aversion to the Uncanny X-Men for too long. Looking at the historical perspective, this was the time when Marvel was having to schedule a lot of reprints in their regular books and fans were getting fed up. DC had some regular reprint books like DC Superstars, Four Star Spectacular, Super Team Family, but by summer of 76, those titles were either gone or featuring new material. The Treasuries must have been treated as a different thing, perhaps as a way of doing high-quality treatments to worthy stories. Maybe more were planned after Batman Strange's cases, but it had the misfortune to be released just before the infamous implosion. Soon after this grace to stands, DC slashed its output. This also led to a lot of layoffs. More things change. Subsequently, there would have been very few people and very little time to research, call, and prepare a Treasury-sized reprint book. And then Ward Hill follows up. He says, I just looked at Mike's Amazing World a little more carefully. Did you think I had all this stuff from my memory? Judging from the planned titles, as well as the Treasuries, reprints were not the horrid things 12-year-old me believed. Just before the axe fell, DC had two new books dedicated to reprints, Dynamic Classics and Battle Classics, each managed to get their first issues onto the stands. The excellence of the DC library and its potential had been recognized as a resource to be minded deliberately, not just keep a title on schedule, whatever became of that idea. There's a lot to parse through there, Ward Hill. That's right. Dynamic Classics and Battle Classics were two series, ongoing reprint books that were killed just in their infancy. Regarding the Treasuries, I think like anything else, if the Treasuries had been selling, I think more consistently, they would have kept going. Like any business, if it's selling, they're going to keep doing it. So maybe Superman versus Muhammad Ali notwithstanding, or some of the other originals, the Treasuries just didn't start holding up sales-wise, and that's why they eventually give up the ghost. And side of DC specifically went over to Digest almost exclusively. Gothos Mansion says, thanks for covering what is probably my favorite comic in my collection. I bought it new back in 1976 at my local Harco Drugs. The text piece was indeed quite a tease back then. All the stories mentioned sounded so exciting, although Gorilla Boss of Gotham City was the only one I had read. Thankfully, thanks to reprints and eBay, I've read them all now. Thank you, Gothos. Robert J. Smith, a.k.a. Protective Gatsby, who was the person that left the wonderful iTunes review last month, says, just to clarify my comments on my Apple review, my number one favorite show on the network is the Who's Who podcast. I can only pray there were no fistfights between the various F&W hosts, all claiming that their show is my favorite. I love you all. Thank you for clarifying, Protective, and thank you for mentioning that your number one favorite show is Who's Who, which is, of course, a show I co-host. So, therefore, I'm filling in your number one and number two slots, and that's the most important thing. Jason Keane says, what a wonderful episode. The pure enjoyment you two got out of this issue was contagious. I have never read any of these stories, but found myself imagining the panels to compare what I knew I'd find there. The nostalgia that you two obviously felt for the various characters and storylines is so relatable. I just felt the need to let you know how much you brightened my day. Thanks. Thank you, Jason. It's a very nice comment. And then finally, Edo Boznar says, late to commenting on this one. It's been, let's say a bad few weeks for me. But doing things like listening to this always wonderful Treasure Cast always brings me up. Thank you, Edo. Otherwise, not much else to say. I never had this book, but I have read a few of the stories elsewhere, like the one with the kids talking about Batman on the campfire. Love it. I'll just highlight something that truly bears emphasis, i.e. Dan's observation that the Bronze Age is actually the Golden Age. I've been saying that for years. So thank you, Edo, for that comment. So that is going to do it for the feedback for this episode of Treasury Cast. We have to wrap up here by mentioning, of course, that if you want to follow the show, all the back episodes are on our website, firewaterpodcast.com. We're always talking Treasury Comics over on Twitter, at Treasury Comics. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And if you want to support the Firewater Podcast Network, you can go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So if you want to be thanked on Treasury Cast, just go over to patreon.com/FW Podcast and leave us an ongoing donation. So that is going to do it for this big 50th episode of Treasury Cast. A couple things I need to mention. Big, huge thanks to Michael Urey, the editor of Back Issue, which helped me put this episode together, get me together with Alex Ross. And of course, big thanks to Alex Ross for taking time out of his very, very busy schedule to sit and talk Treasuries with me. It was an amazing thrill to be able to talk to him and just geek out over this format, and especially speak to someone who I think has contributed so much to this format and has done so much work that I really enjoy. And it was a true honor for him to come by on Treasury Cast and do the show with me. It was just fantastic. So thank you so much, Alex, for doing it. So regarding next month, there will not be an episode of Treasury Cast next month. I want to give this episode a little more time for feedback to build up. I have a feeling that there's going to be slightly more downloads for this episode than your typical installment of Treasury Cast, and I want to make sure that when we do the feedback, I cover it all. So we're not going to do a Treasury Cast in September, but we will be back in October with my guest Ryan Daly. We will be doing our traditional Halloween-themed episode of Treasury Cast. So the book we're going to be covering, I will not mention. We're going to keep it a surprise. But so the show will be back in October. So that is going to do it for Treasury Cast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Until the next episode, go big or go home.
Chosen from among all others by the immortal elders Solomon, Hercules, Atlas, Zeus, Achilles, Mercury, Billy Batson and his mentor travel the highways and byways of the land on a never-ending mission to right wrongs, to develop understanding, and to seek justice for all. In time of dire need, young Billy has been granted the power by the immortals to summon awesome forces at the utterance of a single word.